her washy blue eyes, faded hair and pallid skin. Christina Thomas, seated at the front desk with a smile. Christina Thomas wearing whitish tights that made her legs look like death. It was a warm day. Ifemelu had walked past students sprawled on green lawns. Cheery balloons were clustered below a "Welcome Freshmen" sign. "Good afternoon. Is this the right place for registration?" Ifemelu asked Christina Thomas, whose name she did not then know. "Yes. Now, are you an international student?" "Yes." "You will first need to get a letter from the International Student's Office." Ifemelu half smiled in sympathy, because Christina Thomas had to have some sort of illness that made her speak so slowly, lips scrunching and puckering, as she gave directions to the International Student's Office. But when Ifemelu returned with a letter, Christina Thomas said, "I need you to fill out a couple of forms. Do you understand how to fill these out?" And she realized that Christina Thomas was speaking like that because of her foreign accent, and she felt for a moment like a small child, lazy-limbed and drooling. "I speak English," she said. "I bet you do," Christina Thomas said. "I just don't know how well." Ifemelu shrank. In that strained, still second when her eyes met Christina Thomas's before she took the forms, she shrank. She shrank like a dried leaf. She had spoken English all her life, led the debating society in secondary school, and always thought the American twang inchoate. She should not have cowered and shrunk. But she did. And in the following weeks, as autumn's coolness descended, she began to practice an American accent. School in America was easy. Assignments sent in by email, classrooms air-conditioned, professors willing to give makeup tests. But she was uncomfortable with what the professors called participation, and did not see why it should be part of the final grade. It merely made students talk and talk, class time wasted on obvious words, hollow words, sometimes meaningless words. It had to be that Americans were taught from elementary school to always say something in class, no matter what. And so she sat stiff-tongued, surrounded by students who were all folded easily on their seats, all flush with knowledge, not of the subject of the classes, but of how to be in the classes. They never said, "I don't know." They said instead, "I'm not sure," which did not give any information, but still suggested the possibility of knowledge. And they ambled, these Americans. They walked without rhythm. They avoided giving direct instructions. They did not say, "Ask somebody upstairs." They said, "You might want to ask somebody upstairs." When you tripped and fell, when you choked, when misfortune befell you, they did not say, "Sorry." They said, "Are you okay?" when it was obvious that you were not. And when you said, "Sorry," to them, when they choked or tripped or encountered misfortune, they replied, eyes wide with surprise, "Oh, it's not your fault." And they overused the word "excited." A professor excited about a new book. A student excited about a class. A politician on TV excited about a law. It was altogether too much excitement. Some of the expressions she heard every day astonished her, jarred her, and she wondered what Obinze's mother would make of them. "You shouldn't have done that. There is three things. I had an apple. A couple days. I want to lay down." "These Americans cannot speak English," she told Obinze. On her first day at school, she had visited the health center and had stared a little too long at the bin filled with free condoms in the corner. After her physical, the receptionist told her, "You're all set." And she, blank, wondered what "you're all set" meant, until she assumed it had to mean that she had done all she needed to. She woke up every day worrying about money. If she bought all the textbooks she needed, she would not have enough money to pay her rent, and so she borrowed textbooks during class and made feverish notes, which, reading them later, sometimes confused her. Her new class friend, Samantha, a thin woman who avoided the sun, often saying, "I burn easily," would from time to time let her take a textbook home. "Keep it until tomorrow and make notes if you need to," she would say. "I know how tough things can be. That's why I dropped out of college years ago to work." Samantha was older, and a relief to befriend, because she was not a slack-jawed 18-year-old, as so many others in her communications major were. Still, Ifemelu never kept the books for more than a day, and sometimes refused to take them home. It stung her, to have to beg. Sometimes after classes, she would sit on a bench in the quad and watch the students walking past the large grey sculpture in the middle. They all seemed to have their lives in the shape that they wanted. They could have jobs if they wanted to have jobs, and above them, small flags fluttered serenely from lampposts. She hungered to understand everything about America, to wear a new, knowing skin right away, to support a team at the Super Bowl, understand what a Twinkie was and what sports lockouts meant, measure in ounces and square feet, order a muffin without thinking that it really was a cake, and say, "I scored a deal," without feeling silly. Obinze suggested she read American books, novels and histories and biographies. In his first email to her, a cyber cafe had just opened in Nsoka, he gave her a list of books. The Fire Next Time was the first. She stood by the library shelf and skimmed the opening chapter, braced for boredom. But slowly, she moved to a couch and sat down and kept reading until three-quarters of the book was gone. Then she stopped and took down every James Baldwin title on the shelf. She spent her free hours in the library, so wondrously well lit. The sweep of computers, the large, clean, airy reading spaces, the welcoming brightness of it all, seemed like a sinful decadence. She was used, after all, to reading books with pages missing, fallen off while passing through too many hands. And now, to be in a cavalcade of books with healthy spines. She wrote to Obinze about the book she read, careful, sumptuous letters that opened between them a new intimacy. She had begun finally to grasp the power books had over him. His longing for Ibadan, because of Ibadan, had puzzled her. How could a string of words make a person ache for a place he did not know? But in those weeks, when she discovered the rows and rows of books, with their leathery smell and their promise of pleasures unknown, when she sat, knees tucked underneath her, on an armchair in the lower level, or at a table upstairs with the fluorescent light reflecting off the book's pages, she finally understood. She read the books on Obinze's list, but also randomly pulled out book after book, reading a chapter before deciding which she would speed read in the library and which she would check out. And as she read, America's mythologies began to take on meaning. America's tribalisms, race, ideology, and region became clear, and she was consoled by her new knowledge. "You know," you said, "excited," Obinze asked her one day, his voice amused. "You said you were excited about your media class."
"I did."
New words were falling out of her mouth. Columns of mist were dispersing. Back home, she would wash her underwear every night and hang it in a discreet corner of the bathroom. Now that she piled them up in a basket and threw them into the washing machine on Friday evenings, she had come to see this, the heaping of dirty underwear, as normal. She spoke up in class, buoyed by the book she read, thrilled that she could disagree with professors and get in return not a scolding about being disrespectful, but an encouraging nod. "We watch films in class," she told Obinze. "They talk about films here, as if films are as important as books. So we watch films, and then we write a response paper, and almost everybody gets an A. Can you imagine? These Americans are not serious, though." In her honors history seminar, Professor Moore, a tiny, tentative woman with the emotionally malnourished look of someone who did not have friends, showed some scenes from Roots, the images bright on the board of the darkened classroom. When she turned off the projector, A ghostly white patch hovered on the wall for a moment before disappearing. Ifemelu had first watched Roots on video with Obinze and his mother, sunk into sofas in their living room in Nsoka. As Kunta Kinte was being flogged into accepting his slave name, Obinze's mother got up abruptly, so abruptly she almost tripped on a leather pouf, and left the room, but not before Ifemelu saw her reddened eyes. It startled her that Obinze's mother, fully hemmed into her self-containment, her intense privacy, could cry watching a film. Now, as the window blinds were raised and the classroom once again plunged into light, Ifemelu remembered that Saturday afternoon, and how she had felt lacking, watching Obinze's mother and wishing that she too could cry.
"Let's talk about historical representation in film," Professor Moore said.
A firm female voice from the back of the class, with a non-American accent, asked,
"Why was Niga bleeped out?"
And a collective sigh, like a small wind, swept through the class.
"Well, this was a recording from network television, and one of the things I wanted us to talk about is how we represent history in popular culture, and the use of the N-word is certainly an important part of that,"
Professor Moore said.
"It makes no sense to me," the firm voice said.
Ifemelu turned. The speaker's natural hair was cut as low as a boy's, and her pretty face, wide foreheaded and fleshless, reminded Ifemelu of the East Africans who always won long-distance races on television.
"I mean, nigger is a word that exists. People use it. It is part of America. It has caused a lot of pain to people, and I think it is insulting to bleep it out."
"Well,"
Professor Moore said, looking around as though for help. It came from a gravelly voice in the middle of the class.
"Well, it's because of the pain that word has caused that you shouldn't use it."
"Shouldn't" sailed astringently into the air, the speaker an African-American girl wearing bamboo hoop earrings.
"Thing is, each time you say it, the word hurts African-Americans,"
a pale, shaggy-haired boy in front said. Ifemelu raised her hand. Faulkner's Light in August, which she had just read, was on her mind.
"I don't think it's always hurtful. I think it depends on the intent, and also on who is using it."
A girl next to her, face flushing bright red, burst out,
"No! The word is the same for whoever says it."
"That is nonsense,"
the firm voice again. A voice unafraid.
"If my mother hits me with a stick, and a stranger hits me with a stick, it is not the same thing."
Ifemelu looked at Professor Moore to see how the word nonsense had been received. She did not seem to have noticed. Instead, a vague terror was freezing her features into a smirk smile.
"I agree it's different when African Americans say it, but I don't think it should be used in films, because that way, people who shouldn't use it can use it, and hurt other people's feelings,"
a light-skinned African-American girl said, the last of the four black people in class, her sweater an unsettling shade of fuchsia.
"But it's like being in denial. If it was used like that, then it should be represented like that. Hiding it doesn't make it go away,"
the firm voice.
"Well, if you all hadn't sold us, we wouldn't be talking about any of this,"
the gravelly-voiced African-American girl said, in a lowered tone that was nonetheless audible. The classroom was wrapped in silence. Then rose that voice again.
"Sorry, but even if no Africans had been sold by other Africans, the transatlantic slave trade would still have happened. It was a European enterprise. It was about Europeans looking for labor for their plantations."
Professor Moore interrupted in a small voice,
"Okay, now let's talk about the ways in which history can be sacrificed for entertainment."
After class, Ifemelu and the firm voice drifted towards each other.
"Hi, I'm Wambui. I'm from Kenya. You're Nigerian, right?"
She had a formidable air, a person who went about setting everyone and everything right in the world.
"Yes, I'm Ifemelu."
They shook hands. They would, in the next weeks, ease into a lasting friendship. Wambui was the president of the African Students Association.
You don't know about ASA? You must come to the next meeting on Thursday, she said.
The meetings were held in the basement of Wharton Hall, a harshly lit windowless room, paper plates, pizza cartons and soda bottles piled on a metal table, folding chairs arranged in a limp semicircle. Nigerians, Ugandans, Kenyans, Ghanaians, South Africans, Tanzanians, Zimbabweans, one Congolese and one Guinean sat around eating, talking, fueling spirits, and their different accents formed meshes of solacing sounds. They mimicked what Americans told them.
You speak such good English. How bad is AIDS in your country? It's so sad that people live on less than a dollar a day in Africa.
And they themselves mocked Africa, trading stories of absurdity, of stupidity, and they felt safe to mock, because it was mockery born of longing, and of the heartbroken desire to see a place made whole again. Here, Ifemelu felt a gentle, swaying sense of renewal. Here, she did not have to explain herself. Wambui had told everyone that Ifemelu was looking for a job. Dorothy, the girly Ugandan with long braids who worked as a waitress in Center City, said her restaurant was hiring. But first, Mombek, the Tanzanian double major in engineering and political science, looked over Ifemelu's resume and asked her to delete the 3 years of university in Nigeria. American employers did not like lower-level employees to be too educated. Mombek reminded her of Obinze, that ease about him, that quiet strength. At meetings he made everyone laugh.
I got a good primary education because of Nyerere's socialism, Mombek said often. Otherwise I would be in Dar right now, carving ugly giraffes for tourists.
When two new students came for the first time, one from Ghana and the other from Nigeria, Mombek gave them what he called the welcome talk.
Please, do not go to Kmart and buy 20 pairs of jeans because each costs $5. The jeans are not running away. They will be there tomorrow at an even more reduced price. You are now in America. Do not expect to have hot food for lunch. That African taste must be abolished. When you visit the home of an American with some money, they will offer to show you their house. Forget that in your house back home, your father would throw a fit if anyone came close to his bedroom. We all know that the living room is where it stopped, and if absolutely necessary, then the toilet. But please, smile and follow the American and see the house and make sure you say you like everything. And do not be shocked by the indiscriminate touching of American couples. Standing in line at the cafeteria, the girl will touch the boy's arm and the boy will put his arm around his shoulder and they will rub shoulders and back and rub, rub, rub. But please, do not imitate this behavior.
They were all laughing. Wambui shouted something in Swahili.
Very soon, you will start to adopt an American accent because you don't want customer service people on the phone to keep asking you, what? What? You will start to admire Africans who have perfect American accents, like our brother here, Kofi. Kofi's parents came from Ghana when he was 2 years old, but do not be fooled by the way he sounds. If you go to their house, they eat kenke every day. His father slapped him when he got his C in class. There's no American nonsense in that house. He goes back to Ghana every year. We call people like Kofi American African, not African American, which is what we call our brothers and sisters whose ancestors were slaves.
It was a B minus, not a C, Kofi quipped.
Try and make friends with our African American brothers and sisters in a spirit of true pan-Africanism, but make sure you remain friends with fellow Africans, as this will help you keep your perspective. Always attend African Students Association meetings, but if you must, you can also try the Black Student Union. Please note that in general, African Americans go to the Black Student Union and Africans go to the African Students Association. Sometimes it overlaps, but not a lot. The Africans who go to BSU are those with no confidence who are quick to tell you, I am originally from Kenya, even though Kenya just pops out the minute they open their mouths. The African Americans who come to our meetings are the ones who write poems about Mother Africa and think every African is a Nubian queen. If an African American calls you a mandingo or a booty scratcher. He is insulting you for being African. Some will ask you annoying questions about Africa, but others will connect with you. You will also find that you might make friends more easily with other internationals, Koreans, Indians, Brazilians, whatever, than with Americans, both black and white. Many of the internationals understand the trauma of trying to get an American visa, and that is a good place to start a friendship.
There was more laughter, Mombek himself laughing loudly, as though he had not heard his own jokes before. Later, as Ifemelu left the meeting, she thought of DK, wondered which he would go to in college, ASA or BSU, and what he would be considered, American-African or African-American. He would have to choose what he was, or rather, what he was would be chosen for him. Ifemelu thought the interview at the restaurant where Dorothy worked had gone well. It was for a hostess position, and she wore her nice shirt, smiled warmly, shook hands firmly. The manager, a chortling woman full of a seemingly uncontrollable happiness, told her, "Great! Wonderful to talk to you. You'll hear from me soon." And so when that evening her phone rang, she snatched it up, hoping it was a job offer.
"Ifem, kedu?" Auntie Uju said.
Auntie Uju called too often to ask if she had found a job.
"Auntie, you will be the first person I will call when I do," Ifemelu had said during the last call, only yesterday, and now Auntie Uju was calling again.
"Fine," Ifemelu said, and was about to add, "I have not found anything yet," when Auntie Uju said,
"Something happened with Dike."
"What?" Ifemelu asked.
"Miss Brown told me that she saw him in a closet with a girl. The girl is in third grade. Apparently they were showing each other their private parts."
There was a pause.
"Is that all?" Ifemelu asked. "What do you mean, is that all? He's not yet 7 years old. What type of thing is this? Is this what I came to America for?"
"We actually read something about this in one of my classes the other day. It's normal. Children are curious about things like that at an early age, but they don't really understand it."
"Normal quoi? It's not normal at all."
"Auntie, we were all curious as children."
"Not at 7 years old. Tufi akwa. Where did he learn that from? It is the daycare he goes to. Since Ama left, and he started going to Miss Brown, he has changed. All those wild children with no home training, he is learning rubbish from them. I've decided to move to Massachusetts at the end of this term."
"Uh-uh.
I'll finish my residency there, and DK will go to a better school and better daycare. Bartholomew is moving from Boston to a small town, Warrington, to start his business, so it will be a new beginning for both of us. The elementary school there is very good, and the local doctor is looking for a partner because his practice is growing. I've spoken to him, and he's interested in my joining him when I finish."
"You're leaving New York to go to a village in Massachusetts. Can you just leave residency like that?"
"Of course. My friend Olga, the one from Russia, she is leaving too, but she will have to repeat a year in her new program. She wants to practice dermatology, and most of our patients here are black, and she says skin diseases look different on black skin. And she knows she will not end up practicing in a black area, so she wants to go where the patients will be white. I don't blame her. It's true my program is higher ranked, but sometimes job opportunities are better in smaller places. Besides, I don't want Bartholomew to think I'm not serious. I'm not getting any younger. I want to start trying."
"You're really going to marry him?"
Auntie Uju said with mock exasperation,
"Ifem, I thought we had passed that stage. Once I move, we'll go to court and get married so that he can act as DK's legal parent."
Ifemelu heard the beep-beep of an incoming call.
"Auntie, let me call you back," she said,
and switched over without waiting for Auntie Uju's response. It was the restaurant manager.
"I'm sorry, Ngozi," she said, "but we decided to hire a more qualified person. Good luck."
Ifemelu put the phone down and thought of her mother, how she often blamed the devil.
"The devil is a liar. The devil wants to block us."
She stared at the phone, and then at the bills on her table, a tight, suffocating pressure rising inside her chest. Chapter 15. The man was short, his body a glut of muscles, his hair thinning and sun-bleached. When he opened the door, he looked her over, mercilessly sizing her up, and then he smiled and said,
"Come on in. My office is in the basement."
Her skin prickled, an unease settling over her. There was something venal about his thin-lipped face. He had the air of a man to whom corruption was familiar.
"I'm a pretty busy guy,"
he said, gesturing to a chair in his cramped home office that smelled slightly of damp.
"I assume so from the advertisement," Ifemelu said. "Female personal assistant for busy sports coach in Ardmore. Communication and interpersonal skills required."
She sat on the chair, perched really, suddenly thinking that from reading a city paper ad, she was now alone with a strange man in the basement of a strange house in America. Hands thrust deep in his jeans pockets, he walked back and forth with short, quick steps, talking about how much in demand he was as a tennis coach, and Ifemelu thought he might trip on the stacks of sports magazines on the floor. She felt dizzy just watching him. He spoke as quickly as he moved, his expression uncannily alert. His eyes stayed wide and unblinking for too long.
"So, here's the deal. There are two positions, one for office work and the other for help relaxing. The office position has already been filled. She started yesterday. She goes to Bryn Mawr, and she'll spend the whole week just clearing up my backlog of stuff. I bet I have some unopened checks in there somewhere."
He withdrew a hand to gesture towards his messy desk.
"Now what I need is help to relax. If you want the job, you have it. I'd pay you $100 a day with the possibility of a raise, and you'd work as needed, no set schedule."
$100. Almost enough for her monthly rent. She shifted on the chair.
"What exactly do you mean by help to relax?"
She was watching him, waiting for his explanation. It began to bother her, thinking of how much he had paid for the suburban train ticket.
"Look, you're not a kid,"
he said.
"I work so hard I can't sleep. I can't relax. I don't do drugs, so I figured I need help to relax. You can give me a massage, help me relax, you know. I had somebody doing it before, but she's just moved to Pittsburgh. It's a great gig, at least she thought so. Helped her with a lot of her college debt."
He had said this to many other women, she could tell, from the measured pace with which the words came out. He was not a kind man. She did not know exactly what he meant, but whatever it was, she regretted that she had come. She stood up.
"Can I think about this and give you a call?"
"Of course."
He shrugged, shoulders thick with sudden irritability, as though he could not believe she did not recognize her good fortune. As he let her out, he shut the door quickly, not responding to her final, "Thank you." She walked back to the station, mourning the train fare. The trees were awash with color. Red and yellow leaves tinted the air golden, and she thought of the words she had recently read somewhere, "Nature's first green is gold." The crisp air, fragrant and dry, reminded her of Nsukka during the Harmattan season, and brought with it a sudden stab of homesickness, so sharp and so abrupt that it filled her eyes with tears. Each time she went to a job interview, or made a phone call about a job, she told herself that this would finally be her day. This time, the waitress, hostess, babysitter position would be hers, but even as she wished herself well, there was already a gathering gloom in a far corner of her mind. "What am I doing wrong?" she asked Ginnica, and Ginnica told her to be patient, to have hope. She typed and retyped her resume, invented past waitressing experience in Lagos, wrote Ginnica's name as an employer whose children she had babysat, gave the name of Wambui's landlady as a reference, and at each interview she smiled warmly and shook hands firmly, all the things that were suggested in a book she had read about interviewing for American jobs. Yet there was no job. Was it her foreign accent? Her lack of experience? But her African friends all had jobs, and college students got jobs all the time with no experience. Once, she went to a gas station near Chestnut Street, and a large Mexican man said, with his eyes on her chest,
"You are here for the attendant position. You can work for me in another way."
Then with a smile, the leer never leaving his eyes, he told her the job was taken. She began to think more about her mother's devil, to imagine how the devil might have a hand here. She added and subtracted endlessly, determining what she would need and not need, cooking rice and beans each week and heating up small portions in the microwave for lunch and dinner. Obinze offered to send her some money. His cousin had visited from London and given him some pounds. He would change it to dollars in Enugu. "How can you be sending me money from Nigeria? It should be the other way around," she said. But he sent it to her anyway, a little over $100, carefully sealed in a card. Ginnika was busy, working long hours at her internship and studying for her law school exams, but she called often to check up on Ifemelu's job searching, and always with that upbeat voice, as though to urge Ifemelu towards hope. "This woman I did an internship with, her charity, Kimberly, called me to say her babysitter is leaving and she's looking. I told her about you and she'd like to meet you. If she hires you, she'll pay cash under the table so you won't have to use that fake name. When do you finish tomorrow? I can come and take you to her for an interview."
"If I get this job, I will give you my first month's salary," Ifemelu said, and Ginnika laughed.
Ginnika parked in the circular driveway of a house that announced its wealth, the stone exterior solid and overbearing, four white pillars rising portentously at the entrance. Kimberly opened the front door. She was slim and straight, and raised both hands to push her thick golden hair away from her face, as though one hand could not possibly tame all that hair.
"How nice to meet you," she said to Ifemelu,
smiling as they shook hands, her hand small, bony-fingered, fragile. In her gold sweater belted at an impossibly tiny waist, with her gold hair in gold flats, she looked improbable, like sunlight.
"This is my sister Laura, who's visiting. Well, we visit each other almost every day. Laura practically lives next door. The kids are in the Poconos until tomorrow with my mother. I thought it would be best to do this when they're not here anyway."
"Hi," Laura said. She was as thin and straight and blonde as Kimberly. Ifemelu, describing them to Obinze, would say that Kimberly gave the impression of a tiny bird with fine bones, easily crushed, while Laura brought to mind a hawk, sharp-beaked and dark-minded.
"Hello, I'm Ifemelu."
"What a beautiful name," Kimberly said. "Does it mean anything? I love multicultural names because they have such wonderful meanings from wonderful, rich cultures."
Kimberly was smiling the kindly smile of people who thought culture, the unfamiliar, colourful reserve of colourful people, a word that always had to be qualified with rich. She would not think Norway had a rich culture.
"I don't know what it means," Ifemelu said, and sensed rather than saw a small amusement on Ginnika's face.
"Would you like some tea?"
Kimberly asked, leading the way into a kitchen of shiny chrome and granite, an affluent empty space.
"We're tea drinkers, but of course there are other choices."
"Tea is great," Ginnika said.
"And you, Ifemelu?" Kimberly asked. "I know I'm mauling your name, but it really is such a beautiful name, really beautiful."
"No, you said it properly. I'd like some water or orange juice, please."
Ifemelu would come to realize later that Kimberly used beautiful in a peculiar way.
"I'm meeting my beautiful friend from graduate school," Kimberly would say, or, "we're working with this beautiful woman on the inner city project."
And always, the women she referred to would turn out to be quite ordinary-looking, but always black. One day, late that winter, when she was with Kimberly at the huge kitchen table drinking tea and waiting for the children to be brought back from an outing with their grandmother, Kimberly said,
"Oh, look at this beautiful woman,"
and pointed at a plain model in a magazine, whose only distinguishing feature was her very dark skin.
"Isn't she just stunning?"
"No, she isn't," Ifemelu paused. "You know, you can't just say black. Not every black person is beautiful."
Kimberly was taken aback. Something wordless spread on her face, and then she smiled, and Ifemelu would think of it as the moment they became truly friends. But on that first day, she liked Kimberly, her breakable beauty, her purplish eyes full of the expression Obinze often used to describe the people he liked, obiocha, a clean heart. Kimberly asked Ifemelu questions about her experience with children, listening carefully as though what she wanted to hear was what might be left unsaid.
She doesn't have CPR certification, Kim,
Laura said. She turned to Ifemelu. Are you willing to take the course? It's very important if you're going to have children in your care.
I'm willing to.
Ginnika said you left Nigeria because college professors are always on strike there?
Kimberly asked.
Yes.
Laura nodded knowingly.
Horrible. What's going on in African countries?
How are you finding the U.S. so far?
Kimberly asked. Ifemelu told her about the vertigo she had felt the first time she went to the supermarket. In the cereal aisle, she had wanted to get cornflakes, which she was used to eating back home, but suddenly confronted by 100 different cereal boxes in a swirl of colors and images, she had fought dizziness. She told this story because she thought it was funny. It appealed harmlessly to the American ego. Laura laughed.
I can see how you'd be dizzy.
Yeah, we're really about excess in this country,
Kimberly said.
I'm sure back home you ate a lot of wonderful organic food and vegetables, but you're going to see it's different here.
Kim, if she was eating all this wonderful organic food in Nigeria, why would she come to the U.S.?
Laura asked. As children, Laura must have played the role of the big sister who exposed the stupidity of the little sister, always with kindness and good cheer, and preferably in the company of adult relatives.
Well, even if they had very little food, I'm just saying it was probably all organic vegetables, none of the Franken food we have here,
Kimberly said. Ifemelu sensed between them the presence of spiky thorns floating in the air.
You haven't told her about television?
Laura said.
She turned to Ifemelu. Kim's kids do supervised TV, only PBS, so if she hired you, you would need to be completely present and monitor what goes on, especially with Morgan.
Okay.
I don't have a babysitter,
Laura said, her eye glowing with righteous emphasis.
I'm a full-time, hands-on mom. I thought I would return to work when Athena turned 2, but I just couldn't bear to let her go. Kim is really hands-on, too, but she's busy sometimes. She does wonderful work with her charity. And so I'm always worried about the babysitters. The last one, Martha, was wonderful. But we did wonder whether the one before her, what was her name again, let Morgan watch inappropriate shows. I don't do any television at all with my daughter. I think there's too much violence. I might let her do a few cartoons when she's a little older.
But there's violence in cartoons, too, Ifemelu said.
Laura looked annoyed. It's cartoon. Kids are traumatized by the real thing. Ginnika glanced at Ifemelu, a knitted brow look that said, just leave it alone. In primary school, Ifemelu had watched the firing squad that killed Lawrence Anini, fascinated by the mythologies around his armed robberies, how he wrote warning letters to newspapers, fed the poor with what he stole, turned himself into air when the police came. Her mother had said, go inside, this is not for children, but half-heartedly, after Ifemelu had already seen most of the shooting anyway. Anini's body roughly tied to a pole, jerking as the bullets hit him, before slumping against the crisscross of rope. She thought about this now, how haunting and yet how ordinary it had seemed.
Let me show you the house, Ifemelu, Kimberly said. Did I say it right?
They walked from room to room, the daughter's room with pink walls and a frilly bed cover, the son's room with a set of drums, the den with a piano, its polished wooden top crowded with family photographs.
We took that in India, Kimberly said.
They were standing by an empty rickshaw, wearing T-shirts, Kimberly with her golden hair tied back, her tall and lean husband, her small blonde son and older red-haired daughter, all holding water bottles and smiling. They were always smiling in the photos they took, while sailing and hiking and visiting tourist spots, holding each other, all easy limbs and white teeth. They reminded Ifemelu of television commercials, the people whose lives were lived always in flattering light, whose messes were still aesthetically pleasing.
Some of the people we met had nothing, absolutely nothing, but they were so happy, Kimberly said.
She extracted a photograph from the crowded back of the piano, of her daughter with 2 Indian women, their skin dark and weathered, the smile showing missing teeth. "These women were so wonderful," she said. Ifemela would also come to learn that for Kimberly, the poor were blameless. Poverty was a gleaming thing. She could not conceive of poor people being vicious or nasty, because their poverty had canonized them, and the greatest saints were the foreign poor.
"Morgan loves that. It's Native American.
But Taylor says it's scary."
Kimberly pointed to a small piece of sculpture amid the photographs. "Oh." Ifemelu suddenly did not remember which was the boy and which the girl. Both names, Morgan and Taylor, sounded to her like surnames. Kimberly's husband came home just before Ifemelu left.
"Hello, hello,"
he said, gliding into the kitchen, tall and tanned and tactical. Ifemelu could tell, from the longish length, the near-perfect waves that grazed his collar, that he took fastidious care of his hair.
"You must be Ginnika's friend from Nigeria,"
he said, smiling, brimming with his awareness of his own charm. He looked people in the eye, not because he was interested in them, but because he knew it made them feel that he was interested in them. With his appearance, Kimberly became slightly breathless. Her voice changed. She spoke now in the high-pitched voice of the self-consciously female.
"Don, honey, you're early,"
she said as they kissed. Don looked into Ifemelu's eyes and told her how he had nearly visited Nigeria just after Shagari was elected, when he worked as a consultant to an international development agency. But the trip fell through at the last minute, and he had felt bad because he had been hoping to go to the shrine and see Fela perform. He mentioned Fela casually, intimately, as though it was something they had in common, a secret they shared. There was, in his storytelling, an expectation of successful seduction. Ifemelu stared at him, saying little, refusing to be ensnared, and feeling strangely sorry for Kimberly, to be saddled with a sister like Laura and a husband like this.
"Don and I are involved with a really good charity in Malawi. Actually, Don is much more involved than I am."
Kimberly looked at Don, who made a wry face and said,
"Well, we do our best, but we know very well that we're not messiahs."
"We really should plan a trip to visit. It's an orphanage. We've never been to Africa. I would love to do something with my charity in Africa."
Kimberly's face had softened. Her eyes misted over. And for a moment Ifemelu was sorry to have come from Africa, to be the reason that this beautiful woman with her bleached teeth and bounteous hair would have to dig deep to feel such pity, such hopelessness. She smiled brightly, hoping to make Kimberly feel better.
"I'm interviewing one more person, and then I'll let you know, but I really think you're a great fit for us,"
Kimberly said, leading Ifemelu and Ginnika to the front door.
"Thank you,"
Ifemelu said. "I would love to work for you." The next day, Ginnika called and left a message, her tone low.
"Ifem, I'm so sorry. Kimberly hired somebody else, but she said she'll keep you in mind. Something will work out soon. Don't worry too much. I'll call later."
Ifemelu wanted to fling the phone away. Keep her in mind? Why would Ginnika even repeat such an empty expression? Keep her in mind. It was late autumn. The trees had grown antlers. Dried leaves were sometimes trailed into the apartment, and the rent was due. Her roommate's checks were on the kitchen table, one on top of the other, all of them pink and bordered by flowers. She thought it unnecessarily decorative to have flowered checks in America. It almost took away from the seriousness of a check. Beside the checks was a note, in Jackie's childish writing. "Ifemelu, we're almost a week late for rent." Writing a check would leave her account empty. Her mother had given her a small jar of mentholatum the day before she left Lagos, saying, "Put this in your bag, for when you will be called." She rummaged now in her suitcase for it, opened and sniffed it, rubbing some under her nose. The scent made her want to weep. The answering machine was blinking, but she did not check it because it would be yet another variation of Auntie Uju's message. "Has anyone called you back? Have you tried the nearby McDonald's and Burger King? They don't always advertise, but they might be hiring. I can't send you anything until next month. My own account is empty. Honestly, to be a resident doctor is slave labor." Newspapers were strewn on the floor, job listings circled in ink. She picked one up and flipped through, looking at advertisements she had already seen. Escorts caught her eye again. Ginnica had said to her, "Forget that escort thing. They say it isn't prostitution, but it is. And the worst thing is that you get maybe a quarter of what you earn, because the agency takes the rest. I know this girl who did it in freshman year." Ifemelu read the advertisement and thought again of calling, but she didn't, because she was hoping that the last interview she went for, a waitress position in a little restaurant that didn't pay a salary, only tips, would come through. They had said they would call her by the end of the day if she got the job. She waited until very late, but they did not call. And then Eleanor's dog ate her bacon. She had heated up a slice of bacon on a paper towel, put it on the table, and turned to open the fridge. The dog swallowed the bacon and the paper towel. She stared at the empty space where her bacon had been, and then she stared at the dog, its expression smug, and all the frustrations of her life boiled up in her head. A dog eating her bacon. A dog eating her bacon while she was jobless. "Your dog just ate my bacon," she told Eleanor, who was slicing a banana at the other end of the kitchen, the pieces falling into her cereal bowl. "You just hate my dog.
You should train him better. He shouldn't eat people's food from the kitchen table."
"You better not kill my dog with voodoo."
"What?"
"Just kidding," Eleanor said.
Eleanor was smirking, her dog's tail wagging, and Ifemelu felt acid in her veins. She moved towards Eleanor, hand raised and ready to explode on Eleanor's face, before she caught herself with a jolt, stopped, and turned and went upstairs. She sat on her bed and hugged her knees to her chest, shaken by her own reaction, how quickly her fury had risen. Downstairs, Eleanor was screaming on the phone.
"I swear to God, bitch, just try to hit me!"
Ifemelu had wanted to slap her dissolute roommate, not because a slobbering dog had eaten her bacon, but because she was at war with the world, and woke up each day feeling bruised, imagining a horde of faceless people who were all against her. It terrified her to be unable to visualize tomorrow. When her parents called and left a voice message, she saved it, unsure if that would be the last time she would hear their voices. To be here, living abroad, not knowing when she could go home again, was to watch love become anxiety. If she called her mother's friend, Auntie Bunmi, and the phone rang to the end with no answer, she panicked, worried that perhaps her father had died and Auntie Bunmi did not know how to tell her. Later, Allison knocked on her door.
"Ifemelu, just wanted to remind you, your rent check isn't on the table. We're already really late."
I know. I'm writing it."
She lay face up on her bed. She didn't want to be the roommate who had rent problems. She hated that Ginnica had bought her groceries last week. She could hear Jackie's raised voice from downstairs.
"What are we supposed to do? We're not her fucking parents."
She brought out her checkbook. Before she wrote the check, she called Auntie Uju to speak to DK. Then, refreshed by his innocence, she called the tennis coach in Ardmore.
"When can I start working?"
she asked.
"Want to come over right now?"
"Okay,"
she said. She shaved her underarms, dug out the lipstick she had not worn since the day she left Lagos, most of it left smeared on Obinze's neck at the airport. What would happen with the tennis coach? He had said, "massage," but his manner, his tone, had dripped suggestion. Perhaps he was one of those white men she had read about with strange tastes, who wanted women to drag a feather over their back or urinate on them. She could certainly do that, urinate on a man for $100. The thought amused her, and she smiled a small, wry smile. Whatever happened, she would approach it looking her best. She would make it clear to him that there were boundaries she would not cross. She would say from the beginning, "If you expect sex, then I can't help you." Or perhaps she would say it more delicately, more suggestively. "I'm not comfortable going too far." She might be imagining too much. He might just want a massage. When she arrived at his house, his manner was brusque.
"Come on up,"
he said, and led the way to his bedroom, bare but for a bed, and a large painting of a tomato soup can on the wall. He offered her something to drink, in a perfunctory way that suggested he expected her to say no, and then he took off his shirt and lay on the bed. Was there no preface? She wished he had done things a little more slowly. Her own words had deserted her.
"Come over here," he said. "I need to be warm."
She should leave now. The power balance was tilted in his favour, had been tilted in his favour since she walked into his house. She should leave. She stood up.
"I can't have sex," she said.
Her voice felt squeaky, unsure of itself.
"I can't have sex with you," she repeated.
"Oh, no, I don't expect you to," he said,
too quickly. She moved slowly towards the door, wondering if it was locked, if he had locked it, and then she wondered if he had a gun.
"Just come here and lie down," he said. "Keep me warm. I'll touch you a little bit, nothing you'll be uncomfortable with. I just need some human contact to relax."
There was, in his expression and tone, a complete assuredness. She felt defeated. How sordid it all was, that she was here with a stranger who already knew she would stay. He knew she would stay because she had come. She was already here, already tainted. She took off her shoes and climbed into his bed. She did not want to be here, did not want his active finger between her legs, did not want his sigh moans in her ear, and yet she felt her body rousing to a sickening wetness. Afterwards, she lay still, coiled and deadened. He had not forced her. She had come here on her own. She had lain on his bed, and when he placed her hand between his legs, she had curled and moved her fingers. Now, even after she had washed her hands, holding the crisp, slender $100 bill he had given her, her fingers still felt sticky. They no longer belonged to her.
"Can you do twice a week? I'll cover your train fare," he said,
stretching and dismissive. He wanted her to leave. She said nothing.
"Shut the door,"
he said, and turned his back to her. She walked to the train, feeling heavy and slow, her mind choked with mud. And seated by the window, she began to cry. She felt like a small ball, adrift and alone. The world was a big, big place, and she was so tiny, so insignificant, rattling around emptily. Back in her apartment, she washed her hands with water so hot that it scalded her fingers, and a small, soft welt flowered on her thumb. She took off all her clothes and squashed them into a rumpled ball that she threw at a corner, staring at it for a while. She would never again wear those clothes, never even touch them. She sat naked on her bed and looked at her life, in this tiny room with the mouldy carpet, the $100 bill on the table, her body rising with loathing. She should never have gone there. She should have walked away. She wanted to shower, to scrub herself, but she could not bear the thought of touching her own body. And so she put on her nightdress, gingerly, to touch as little of herself as possible. She imagined packing her things, somehow buying a ticket and going back to Lagos. She curled on her bed and cried, wishing she could reach into herself and yank out the memory of what had just happened. Her voicemail light was blinking. It was probably Obinze. She could not bear to think of him now. She thought of calling Ginnika. Finally, she called Auntie Uju.
"I went to work for a man in the suburbs today. He paid me $100.
"Hey, that's very good. But you have to keep looking for something permanent. I've just realized I have to buy health insurance for DK, because the one this new hospital in Massachusetts offers is nonsense. He does not cover him. I'm still in shock by how much I have to pay."
"Won't you ask me what I did, Auntie? Won't you ask me what I did before the man paid me $100?
Ifemelu asked, a new anger sweeping over her, threading itself through her fingers so that they shook.
"What did you do?" Auntie Uju asked flatly.
Ifemelu hung up. She pressed new on her machine. The first message was from her mother, speaking quickly to reduce the cost of the call.
Ifem, how are you? We are calling to see how you are. We have not heard from you in a while. Please send a message. We are well. God bless you.
Then, Obinze's voice, his words floating into the air, into her head.
I love you, Ifem,
he said, at the end, in that voice that seemed suddenly so far away, part of another time and place. She lay rigid on her bed. She could not sleep. She could not distract herself. She began to think about killing the tennis coach. She would hit him on the head over and over with an axe. She would plunge a knife into his muscled chest. He lived alone. He probably had other women coming to his room to spread their legs for his stubby finger with its bitten back nail. Nobody would know which of them had done it. She would leave the knife sunk in his chest, and then search his drawers for his bundle of $100 bills so that she could pay her rent and her tuition. That night, it snowed, her first snow, and in the morning she watched the world outside her window, the parked cars made lumpy, misshapen by layered snow. She was bloodless, detached, floating in a world where darkness descended too soon, and everyone walked around burdened by coats and flattened by the absence of light. The days drained into one another, crisp air turning to freezing air, painful to inhale. Obinze called many times, but she did not pick up her phone. She deleted his voice messages unheard and his emails unread, and she felt herself sinking, sinking quickly, and unable to pull herself up. She woke up torpid each morning, slowed by sadness, frightened by the endless stretch of day that lay ahead. Everything had thickened. She was swallowed, lost in a viscous haze, shrouded in a soup of nothingness. Between her and what she should feel, there was a gap. She cared about nothing. She wanted to care, but she no longer knew how. It had slipped from her memory, the ability to care. Sometimes she woke up flailing and helpless, and she saw in front of her and behind her and all around her an utter hopelessness. She knew there was no point in being here, in being alive, but she had no energy to think concretely of how she could kill herself. She lay in bed and read books and thought of nothing. Sometimes she forgot to eat, and other times she waited until midnight, her roommates in their rooms, before heating up her food. And she left the dirty plates under her bed until greenish mould fluffed up around the oily remnants of rice and beans. Often, in the middle of eating or reading, she would feel a crushing urge to cry, and the tears would come, the sobs hurting her throat. She had turned off the ringer of her phone. She no longer went to class. Her days were stilled by silence and snow. Allison was banging on her door again.
Are you there? Phone call! She says it's an emergency, for God's sake. I know you're there. I heard you flush the toilet a minute ago.
The flat, dulled banging, as though Allison was hitting the door with an open palm rather than a knuckle, unnerved Ifemelu.
She's not opening, she heard Allison say.
And then just when she thought Allison had left, the banging resumed. She got up from her bed, where she had been lying and taking turns reading two novels, chapter by chapter, and with leaden feet moved to the door. She wanted to walk quickly, normally, but she could not. Her feet had turned into snails. She unlocked the door. With a glare, Allison thrust the phone in her hand.
Thanks,
she said, limply, and added in a lower mumble, sorry. Even talking, making words rise up her throat and out of her mouth, exhausted her.
Hello,
she said into the phone.
Ifem, what's going on? What's happening to you?
Ginnika asked.
Nothing, she said. I've been so worried about you. Thank God I found your roommate's number. Obinze has been calling me. He's worried out of his mind, Ginnika said. Even Auntie Uju called to ask if I had seen you.
I've been busy, Ifemelu said vaguely.
There was a pause. Ginnika's tone softened.
Ifem, I'm here. You know that, right?
If Emela wanted to hang up and return to her bed. Yes.
I have good news. Kimberly called me to ask for your phone number. The babysitter she hired just left.